It's been a long time since I talked about my fiancé and the events surrounding our vacation at her parents' cabin in Colorado. But I think enough time has passed. I finally unearthed the secrets Faye's family has been hiding from me. We moved 2 weeks ago. I got a new job. We found a new place a few towns over. It's only an hour drive from our old place, and it's the same distance from Faye's work, but in the opposite direction. As if by the law of horror film cliches. The strange activity that plagued us at night ceased entirely for a week when we moved into our new place. However, it started up again after a while, just as I feared it might. Our new home had not yet been blessed by Angela when the activity started again. She's the daughter of the Shoshone tribal elder who saged and blessed our old home a few weeks prior. The imposter has not given up on Faye. Its game is to wear us down until we just give up. I had a Skype chat set up with Faye's very reticent mother, but per your guys' warnings, I waited until after we moved. The fear was that Laura might divulge something over Skype that the imposter could use against us. The more it discovered about us, the more closely it can mimic me and any of Faye's family members, living or dead. When she's asleep, Faye is highly susceptible to suggestion. The running hypothesis No Sleep has developed is that there are certain things the imposter needs to know about Faye in order to fully infiltrate her, to control her, to kill her. We don't really know what's planned to do with her, but we do know that it is especially curious about the significance of the number 5, which Faye drew on a window while sleepwalking. She gets agitated any time 5 is brought up, cannot coherently explain why. I think that once I learn the meaning of the number, it'll have full access to Faye and will be able to do whatever it's planning with her. I think that once it learns the meaning of the number, it will have full access to Faye and will be able to do whatever it's planning with her. I sat on the couch with my laptop and Skyped Laura around 10 p.m. one night in our new place. About a half hour later, Faye had fallen asleep. I had to be extremely aggressive in order to break Laura's wall of lies about her family's past, and just when she seemed ready to crack, Faye walked out of the bedroom. We now live in a one-story house. It was dark in the hall, so she scared the shit out of me when I saw her movement out of the corner of my eye. She stood there in the shadows, rigid and still. Her entire body was stiff and her head was craned all the way back in a painful position. Her chin pointed at the ceiling and her arms were straight up in the air in an hallelujah gesture. She hadn't sleepwalked in a while now, so I immediately told Laura I'd call her back and jumped up. Faye shushed me and wiggled her fingers, arms still outstretched. She looked like a praying mantis in repose. I asked, "Faye, what is it?" She smiled and replied, "Did you know about her?" She closed her hands, and one of her fingers pointed at the ceiling. I said I didn't know what she was talking about and asked, "What? Know what?" I looked up at the ceiling and I saw nothing. Faye paused. She typically pauses for long periods between sentences while sleepwalking and then said, "There's an old woman up there. She lives in the attic. She's so friendly. She remembered my birthday." My skin crawled. It felt like insects skittering under my clothes when she said that. Faye says a lot of disturbing things, and I've grown used to it, but occasionally she still surprises me. I asked her more about this woman, and she said, "She sleeps right above our bed." They brought her arms down to her sides and her muscles relaxed. She stopped answering my questions. I walked her back to the bedroom and gently tucked her in. That night, I lay awake in the dark staring up at the ceiling. I imagined the corpse of an old woman stuck inside the drywall or dangling from the rafters in the attic. couldn't shake the feeling that our unwanted guest had moved in with us, and was now pretending to be a friendly stranger to trick Faye. That night I dreamed of a dark stain spreading itself across the ceiling in the shape of a large man. Just like the vomit stains in our old house a few weeks prior. As I was falling asleep, I thought I heard something heavy dragging itself around up there. Laura called the following evening. Faye wasn't home from work yet, so we had a good hour-long conversation before things got uncomfortable. I had to spend a lot of time getting her back into that emotional space where she could open up about her daughter, and when she finally did, I was astonished. It felt like the first time Laura had ever told me the truth about anything. I don't have any proof that she was being honest, but I could hear it in her voice. It's true that Faye was 5 years old when she developed her unusual sleep disorder, but the number 5 does not symbolize that. It goes a lot deeper. As I mentioned before in a previous update, Faye's parents lied to me and told me that she had been visiting the cabin in Pike's Peak regularly throughout her life until she was 13, and yet Faye claimed she had never been there before, ever. In reality, Faye went there a few times as a child, but her last visit was at age 5. Her and her father Greg were outside building a snowman, but then Faye walked the tree line and began speaking with someone that Greg could not see. She spoke her own name, and said a few other things that Greg couldn't hear, then had some sort of seizure and became catatonic. When she came to, she cried for hours. But there was apparently more to the story. Just as Faye got home from work and walked in the door, I heard Laura say, "A few months before that, I was pregnant." The second I covered the mouthpiece and said, "Hey, sweetie," Laura hung up the phone. Now, I keep this revelation to myself for a while. Laura didn't return my calls after Faye went to bed, so I never found out what happened to her pregnancy. Did she have a miscarriage and abortion? Did she give the baby up for adoption? Was it not Greg's child? Millions of questions swam through my mind. I didn't sleep at all, and I could barely hide my thoughts from Faye. She knew something was wrong. She was quite perceptive and can read me like a book, but I acted like I had a stomach ache and I went to bed. That night I had an absolutely terrible dream, probably the worst one that I have ever had. In it, an adult Faye attacked her pregnant mother. She was sleepwalking, but screaming wildly and pummeling her mother, just like she pummeled the guest bedroom door when her sister and infant nephew, Becca and Caleb, visited us last month. There was blood everywhere in the dream. And Faye ran off into the woods with the fetus. It was so violent, I jolted awake, nearly screaming. When I woke up, Faye was sitting upright in bed, staring out the window. She was awake, I could tell, because her posture was normal and her eyes weren't rolled back and her head were blissfully sealed shut. She said, "Did you hear it too?" It took me a while to figure out where I was. When I saw her sitting there in a pristine white t-shirt, I sighed in relief. There was no blood anywhere. It's just a dream. Before I could answer her question, I heard a baby crying. Now, we live in a bigger suburban area now, so it was entirely possible that it was just a sound from one of the nearby houses, but Faye's reaction to it really disturbed me. The look on her face made me think that the sound was causing her physical pain. She cringed, shut her eyes, trying not to cry. I cupped her face in my hands and I told her it was okay. But as I did, another voice rang out from the dark. It was a little girl and she was speaking as if to a baby. From what I could hear, she said, "When do we go inside?" "Up in the trees, where?" "Not the hole, not down there." Faye started crying too. I looked out the window, but I couldn't see anything. She had no explanation for why she was so upset other than, "He's back. He's here. I know it's him." I didn't want to scare her, but I completely agreed. I had a missed call from Nathan the next morning when I woke up. It was Saturday, and Faye and I had plans to get new furniture at IKEA. While she was in the shower, I returned Nathan's call. He answered on the first ring. He sounded terrible. The first thing he said was, "Felix, do you know anything about the child?" A few weeks prior, he had said, "Tell me about the child," and I had no idea what he was talking about. Now I had a pretty clear idea, so I whispered to him that Faye's mother had been pregnant when Faye was 5. But I had no idea what became of the baby. He told me to get as much information from Laura as possible, at all costs, but to keep it from Faye. He also told me that he was going to mail us a special herbal mixture. "Something to make into a tea before bed. He said it promotes good dreams, and therefore would shield us from some of the imposter's intrusion." I asked Nathan to explain what he meant. He said very simply, "The imposter does not read minds. It reads dreams." This was an astonishing revelation to me. It explained so much about the cabin. The imposter is mimicking Faye's grandfather because she probably had a dream about him at the cabin. It mimicked my mother for the same reason. It mimicked the people that Greg saw die in the war because he frequently had nightmares about them. The former owner of the cabin, Jennifer, heard her dead daughter's voice in the forest at night because she regularly had dreams about her. Who didn't have painful dreams about their own child passing away? Who didn't have painful dreams about their own child who passed away? The creature mimics the people it learns about through the dreams of its victims and repeats them in the forest to coax those victims outside. It also listens to the things that people say when they're awake. This is why we heard so many unrecognizable and familiar voices at the same time. Some of those voices belong to other victims. That thing was wandering around in the dark, learning from its targets, sharpening its skills, and pretending. That's how it hunts. So since I was getting nearer to the significance of the number 5, the information the imposter so desperately sought, Faye was in greater danger. My own dreams could betray our safety. Nathan continued, and I'm just paraphrasing because I can't remember everything verbatim. Faye is the most fascinating person the imposter has ever encountered. Her dreams are a mystery to it. She's a puzzle to be solved. And most of all, when it speaks to her through her dreams, she speaks back. I guess you could say it has a very dark fixation with her, perhaps even love. A putrid form of it, anyway. It was true. Faye mirrored the imposter's darkness when it looked into her, and it didn't find all the hopes and dreams and fears it saw in others. Instead, it saw a deep well of impenetrable blackness, and it knew there was something hidden beneath it. Whatever it was planning to do with that information it seeks, it knows that 5 is the light that will reveal the bottom of that well and everything inside of it. Cold sweat matted every inch of my skin during this conversation. I pressed the phone tighter to my ear so as not to miss a word. I asked, why does it even need Faye to find the answer? Her parents probably know what the number means too. Nathan said something in his native language as though he was speaking to a person sitting in the room with him. And he said her parents haven't been in the cabin in a very long time. Its connection to them is weak. Maybe it can't keep hold of someone for very long. If they aren't on the mountain, after all, Faye has had her sleep disorder since she went to Pike's Peak. But as the years passed, his entity faded from her life. It only returned when she came back. I heard the shower turn off, the glass door slide open, and Faye began moving around the bathroom. I walked outside onto the patio and closed the door behind me. "But what does it want, Nathan?" I asked. "I mean, once it learns everything it needs, what does it plan to do? Nobody will give me a straight answer." Again, Nathan said something that I could not understand. He was talking to someone else, perhaps one of the elders of his community. "It is one of the old evils," he said. "Our people have believed in them since the beginning. When a person dies, sometimes they become a... what do you call them? A wraith? A haunting? But these entities were here long before. So many horror films Faye and I cheerfully watched came flooding into my mind." "So like a demon," I said. "I can't tell you how many movies I've seen where a family finds out the ghost in their house is actually a demon. And for a few obscure reasons, it's much worse." I felt like I was about to be given that speech. Nathan cleared his throat. "Well, no. Not exactly. We don't believe in hell or any equivalent place. Our interpretation of the other worlds is very complex, but basically, this type of entity, they take you away. Not your body, your spirit. They take it out into the dark, away from this world and its light. So far away. Eternities upon eternities away. The distance drives your spirit completely mad, and then you become one of them. That's what it does. He separates you from where you're supposed to be going into the afterlife. It steals you from yourself. Yeah, good news all around. I also asked Nathan how he was coping with his father's death and pointed out that he sounded especially dreary today. Again, I expressed my condolences and said that I was most honored to have known T.U.A. and that we were alive because of him. Nathan replied that he knows his father's spirit lives on through his family and in the sacred earth where they live. For that reason, he does not mourn his death. However, Nathan also said something that made my hand go cold as I clutched the phone. He said, "I keep having the same nightmare every night. It keeps me awake. When it's over, I'm exhausted." I asked him to tell me about the dream, as I've been having terrible ones lately too. He said, "It's the cabin. I see it in my dreams. It's sitting there in the dark, and there's a bad storm. I'm standing in the distance looking at it. A light turns on inside and I walk toward it. As I approach, the front door slowly opens and something in my heart tells me not to step inside. But I do. Every time I do. When I'm inside, the light cuts out. It's very dark. From the living room, I can hear my father's voice calling out to me from the bedroom. He's speaking in our language and sounds happy and peaceful. He tells me to come to him. And that he wants us to see my face before he goes to be with our ancestors. He calls me Hanatue, my light. The nickname I was given as a child. But when I go to push the bedroom door open, I wake up to the sound of a child crying. Every time. Nathan went on to explain that he feels these dreams are a sign, and that he must return to the cabin and the site of T-Way's death. I said, "It could be a trap, you know. In fact, I'm sure it is." Nathan spoke once more in his language to whoever was in the room with him, and then he paused. And he finally sighed and said, "You might be right. But it really feels like him." I made him promise not to go back to the cabin. He agreed, and said he'd call me in a few days. I thanked him again for his father's sacrifice. A few days passed in relative peace. Laura did not return my calls, and Becca, Faye's sister, did not return my texts. The standoffishness of this family drives me insane. When Faye and I got home from doing groceries one evening, a package had finally arrived in the mail. It contained the herbs that Nathan had talked about, with instructions on how to make them into a tea. "Not too much," read the little note. Faye brewed some of it up and drank it. When she was finished, I jokingly told her, "Actually, we were sending you on a vision quest. This is going to be really intense." She wasn't amused. We both slept soundly that night. No bad dreams, no strange activity outside, no weird sounds. The next morning, there was a knock at the door, so light, it only woke me up. See, I'm a light sleeper, insomniac of the family. I snuck out of bed, trying not to wake up Faye, and crept to the front door. It was Laura. She had come to our new home, totally unannounced and uninvited. I immediately knew that there was about to be a shitstorm. I couldn't begin to imagine what she was doing here, but I knew by the look on her face that there was trouble. I invited her inside and informed her that Faye was still asleep. She was actually relieved and said that she wanted to talk to me alone. From her bag, she produced a photo album. We sat on the couch, where she quietly apologized to me for everything. For being constantly evasive, for lying, and for letting us go to that cabin in the first place. I waved away her ramblings and demanded to know the purpose of her visit. I had absolutely had enough of all of this. I wanted to get to the bottom of things. Laura dropped her voice to a whisper and opened the photo album. As she turned the pages, I realized that it was actually a scrapbook, a very elaborate one that had taken years of effort to construct. There were photos, drawings, designs, letters and postcards, even a necklace and some flattened flowers. I saw pictures of Faye that I had never seen before. She was absolutely adorable as a child. Her glowing smile poked out from beneath little strawberry locks in photo after photo. Laura said, "This is what I wanted to show you. I don't know how to talk to Faye about it." See, I was amazed. "It took expert handiwork to craft something like this. You made this?" I asked. She flipped further into the scrapbook and revealed a few old pictures of herself in the later stages of pregnancy. The centerpiece of one of the pages was a photograph of Laura, big-bellied and bearing a youthful smile. And little 5-year-old Faye, curiously resting her ear on her mother's tummy. It was a priceless image. And one that hadn't seen the light of day in decades. "Faye and I put this together, actually," she replied. "When she was very little, it made sense. Faye is one of the most talented arts and crafts hobbyists I've ever known." "So, what happened?" I asked. Laura looked over her shoulder and down the hall. She obviously feared Faye would wake up. "His name was Christopher," she said. Tears welled up in her eyes as she spoke. When she turned the page, there was a photo of Laura undergoing an ultrasound and giving a thumbs up. "He was stillborn a little over a month before the due date." I had no idea what to say. I felt that saying "I'm sorry" was too empty, so instead I just remained silent. "Placenta abruption," she continued. "It's rare, but it happens." She scooted closer to me on the couch and set the scrapbook on my lap and then grabbed my wrist. She said, "Felix, Faye doesn't remember any of this. We have never, ever spoken of it." I asked how that could be possible, given that she was certainly old enough to remember an event like this. Laura explained that the emergency occurred while Greg was out with the girls. The paramedics rushed Laura to the hospital, but the baby could not be saved. When she and Greg finally decided to break the news to their daughters that Christopher had died, Becca was brokenhearted. But Faye did not react. It was as if what they were telling her simply didn't register. Laura would say, "You understand that Christopher is never coming home?" They would respond, "Yes, Mommy," with a blank expression. This went on for weeks. Faye would occasionally ask about Christopher as if he'd be visiting soon, and suddenly she'd not remember anything about him, as if he never existed. She began to act out at school and would throw violent tantrums for no reason. A child psychologist warned that Faye was not handling the situation well, so Laura and Greg decided to spend several days up at the cabin with the girls in hopes of separating little Faye's mind from the heavy event. That's when it happened. Whatever it is that lives in the forest, up there, up in the trees, or down in the hole, took notice of Faye. It wanted to learn more, but her little brain shut down in terror when it got too close. Laura said after that day, Faye never spoke of Christopher again, and seems completely unaware that he even existed. Quite suddenly, Faye's voice erupted from behind us. She was standing in the hallway, perhaps for a long time. I slammed the book shut. The air went out of the room. There was an agonizingly long moment of stillness before which all of us exchanged surprised looks. "What's that?" she finally asked, pointing at the scrapbook in my lap. I was useless. A deer in the headlights. Laura got up and got between me and Faye, giving her a hug and asking how she was feeling. She said they needed to talk. But Faye pushed her aside and walked over to the couch, her fiery eyes locked on the scrapbook and didn't blink. She reached down and opened it, and the page she revealed had a colorful cutout of the number 5. It was one of the final pages of the book. Her jaw trembled, and tears instantly welled in her eyes. A look of excruciating pain fell over her face, and she began hyperventilating. Laura rounded the couch and tried to assuage her, but Faye slapped her hand away and grabbed the scrapbook, then raced off to the bedroom. She cried in there for hours, and never let us in. I spent the rest of the day alone. They never emerged from the bedroom and wouldn't speak to me when I knocked, so I played Overwatch to distract myself from the horrible knot of stress in my stomach. Meanwhile, texting with my best friend Richard and Jason regarding the new developments. When I got up for a drink, I heard the bedroom door click. Faye was ready to let me in. She was sitting on the bed with the scrapbook in her lap when I pushed the door open. And I said as gently as I could, "You want to talk about it?" Her face was streaked with hundreds of tears, her skin was pale, and her eyes were lifeless. Never had I seen her in such a state. I considered calling the paramedics for fear that she might hurt herself. "Or me," she said. "I remember now." I stood there in the doorway, afraid to make a move. I wasn't sure how Faye would react to the knowledge that I had been conspiring with her mother about their secret past. "Mom and I spent all summer getting the nursery set up," she said, tracing her finger over one of the photos. "Dad was so excited that he was finally going to have a son. So we did a sports theme." I walked over to the bed and sat down, white as a lamb, trying not to trigger another explosion. Faye kept her hands pressed on the scrapbook as though she were feeling for a pulse. The colorful number 5 rested at the center of the page, laid over various photos. In one, there was a baseball mural painted on the wall with 5 players, and in another, a toddler onesie in the design of a baseball jersey. It displayed the number 5. They started crying again and choked out that Christopher was going to be the 5th member of our family. We talked for a long time. Mostly Faye talked. I just quietly watched her face in awe as a deluge of ancient memories flooded her mind. Sometimes she could barely speak, other times she shook her head and said it was all a dream. Her denial rose and fell in waves, and she grasped at all the faded images in her head and tried to describe them to me with great strain. A tomb had been unearthed, and Faye was excavating it despite the pain that it wrought on her. All I could do was hold her hand through it. That night I made Nathan's tea again, and we both drank it. Faye fell asleep and I stayed awake watching Netflix. Just as I was about to shut off the computer, I heard rustling outside. And then I heard the voice of a little girl.
"It's Faye. I can see you. Who are you?"
I walked down the hall and peered out of the blinds in the living room. A dark figure walked right past the window, scaring me half to death. It came from our backyard and no doubt had been standing beside our bedroom window. I ran down the hall and grabbed my sweats and shoes and bolted to the door and locked it all around the property. There, across the road, standing under a street lamp, was a man. His body glowed in the pale yellow light, but his face was totally black. He looked nearly 7 feet tall, and one of his shoulders was noticeably higher than the other. His posture was rigid and reminiscent of the way that Faye sleepwalked. I knew exactly who it was. I can't explain what prompted me to run after him, but I wanted to grab this thing by the neck and beat it to death with my bare hands. Perhaps it was because I was so tired. My fear instinct hadn't yet kicked in, or perhaps I had just had enough. But inside, instead of clawing me to death right there in the street, the figure turned and ran, and I chased after him, screaming at the top of my lungs to stay the fuck away from my family in my house. The thing moved very fast, but limped with a freakish gait. My mind envisioned a rail-thin creature made of oily black parts, stretching on the costume of a human and gracelessly lurching around in it. The thing was not a person. Its movements were animalistic. Its strides far too long. Its breath wheezed the air like an antique accordion, and the stench that dragged behind it stung my nose. It smelled like wildfire. No words for you to fuck around in out here, I screamed. Lights flicked on in houses all around me as I chased the figure. It practically galloped and was always 20 feet ahead of me. I chased it down for 2 blocks. It rounded a few turns and finally bounded over a chain-link fence into the community park where there was no lights and I couldn't see a damn thing, so I had to run all the way around to the other side to get in. The only thing I could see was a silhouette. The figure stood there in the empty field, shrouded in the night. Gazing up at the moon, the silver outline of its body indicated that it was facing away from me. One of its hands twitched wildly, the other was gnarled up like driftwood. The sight of it out here, so far from help, unnerved me. I approached it, still committed to ending this nightmare tonight, one way or the other. My courage evaporated about 10 feet from the figure when it issued a growl that I couldn't even describe. It was so deep, I felt it in my ribcage, as much as I heard it. I stopped in my tracks, but still managed to say, "You'll never take her. You'll never have Faye. You'll leave us alone forever. Go back to that fucking mountain and bury yourself in a mine." It growled again. And then gurgled up a wet laugh. "What's your name?" it asked in my voice. They had been practicing. It was perfect now. "May I come in?" How do you carry on a conversation with an entity that's basically a demonic parrot? I said much louder than before, "You will leave us alone and go back to the mountain. Faye will never be yours." The imposter emitted the shrieking of an infant. The sound startled me and felt so wrong coming out of that form of such a large man. And then it said, in the voice of a child, "You go down the hall. That's where he'll put you. Look at me, you piece of shit," I said, trying to sound menacing, but in reality, I'm a coward. Most people can sense it, so there was a little doubt the imposter knew it too. Then it said something I didn't expect. The sound threw me off so much my head spun. "Tell me about the child," it said. Nathan's voice wafted gently from its throat. "Tell me about the child." Before I could speak, the imposter whirled around and squared off with me. There are no words to express the combination of shock and instant despair that I felt. My knees came straight up from under my body, and I fell to the wet grass, staring down at me, boring into me with lidless eyes. It was the face of Nathan. My friend. My protector, the son of a man who'd given his life to help me. Now his skin was hard and bruised, his scalp flayed, his eyes tormented. He'd been stretched over a skull that didn't quite fit, and a body that rattled with loose, collected bones, a slimy black liquid dribbled down the arms. Perhaps it was blood. It was too dark to tell. It spoke a phrase in a language of Nathan's people, and the same one Nathan had uttered over the phone last month that made us sick, and I began vomiting profusely as I lay on the ground. "Tell me about the child," it said once more, and smiled. her lips spread and stretched in an expression of malevolent joy, bearing the rotten maw of a long-dead wolf. Nathan's calm voice seeped out of it. "Let me speak to the one who followed you home." I gasped for air but couldn't command my body to move. The creature took a few steps toward me, and I slammed shut my eyes, expecting to feel those hideous fangs in my neck. Instead, I heard its footsteps approach, and then recede in the opposite direction. When I opened my eyes, the imposter had stepped over me and was walking away. It was already in the distance, moving quickly. Back towards my neighborhood. Toward my house. "Followed you home," it repeated, voice echoing in the chilled night air. "Followed you home. Followed you home. Followed you home."